I'm feeling wonderful right now. This is my dream cast. Four of them were in the original workshop production of this play last May at Portland Stage. It's a workshop week called Little Festival of the Unexpected, and Papermaker was one of three plays in rotation, new works that they did that week. And the four of the actors I have right now for the main stage production were in that reading of the play. So,
and you're still rewriting it as you go along, approaching the opening night?
I am. I certainly hope I won't be rewriting on opening night, but we have done a lot of not major rewriting. I added one little scene that doesn't even have lines. It's just more of a tableau on the stage that I thought was necessary. And these are things that some of them I just kind of come up with when I see what's happening in the room, but others are an actor might ask me for clarification on a line, or Sally Wood, who's the director, she's the only person on earth at this point who knows this play as well as I do. And so we've had a lot of talks about the arc of the play, at which point we need a little less, a little more. So it's been a wonderful, wonderful thing for me because I'm used to working in isolation. I'm a novelist. Mm-hmm. I don't consult with anybody during my creative process. And this is completely different and a joy. Yeah.
Tell us a bit more about that, if you would. How you were saying how starkly different it is, seeing your work come to life in front of your eyes.
Well, it's funny. I've always said that when I write a novel, if 100,000 people read it, it means I've written 100,000 novels, because everybody brings their own stuff to a piece of work. But I never get to see, I don't know what pictures they're making in their head when they read my characters. I don't know how they're interpreting my words. And in this case, I'm looking at these characters who were created inside my head without, you know, I don't really picture my characters physically. Even though my writing is quite visual, when I'm writing, I see words. That's how I see, is in words. And so this has been so interesting because now I'm looking at Jake, my character, and he looks exactly like an actor named Peter Albrink. He talks exactly like an actor named Peter Albrink. And this actor named Peter Albrink now owns Jake in a way that I never will again. And the same with all the other actors. I feel as if I've given over my characters, I've handed them over to people who will take care of them in a certain way, and that's who they now will be.
And the characters in this play were largely the characters you'd already created in the novel Ernie's Ark.
Yes.
But you're saying when you wrote that novel, you didn't really have a firm picture of what they look like.
Not really. Yeah. I didn't. And there are descriptions in there, but normally when I describe characters, it's not really their physical characteristics. It's more from within. Mm-hmm. And now here they are right in front of me, and they look a certain way. They walk a certain way. It's been really interesting and a little disorienting as well.
But you like it?
I do like it. It's been a marvelous process.
Tell us about Papermaker.
Papermaker is a two-act play that takes place at the end of the third month of a bitter, violent labor strike in a small Maine town in 1989. It's about two families, one labor, one management, and how they, through circumstances I can't reveal here, come face to face and are forced to recognize each other's humanity. So it's really a family play. It's a play about family dynamics, which is all I ever really write about, honestly. But the backdrop is so huge. It's about labor politics and small town culture and clashes of culture. So there's a lot going on in the play. It's very layered. And I've been fortunate to have actors who can tease out the nuances that I hoped to write into their script. Mm-hmm.
And although it's fictional, it very much reflects your background. You grew up in Mexico near Rumford, where there was a 3-month strike in 1986, and then the bigger strike in nearby Jay. Mm-hmm. So how much is this play influenced by what really happened?
It's not, well, at this point, it's almost hard to remember what really happened because I'm so much in the world of my fictional retelling of it. there are elements of both of those strikes in the play. But I think, honestly, and there's certainly many elements of the book Ernie's arc, but honestly, I think the true raw material comes from a memoir that I wrote 2 years ago called When We Were the Kennedys, and it's about growing up in Mexico, Maine, in the year 1963, when I was 9 years old. And I think all of that source material, if somebody wants to know where my work comes from, that would be the book to read, honestly. Mm. It's about, you know, I'm from a mill family. My brother worked in the mill all his life. My father worked in the mill all his life. My grandfather worked in the mill all his life. We were a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat union family. And now here I am, all grown up out in the world, dealing with all kinds of different people who have very different politics from mine. And, you know, you learn to... And as a writer, I have to have empathy for everybody, for people who are very, very different from me. That's my job.
And growing up, you weren't necessarily of the background where you would empathize with the management, but you find yourself having to do this with the play.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Well, when I wrote the book, the character who actually interested me the most was this guy, Henry McCoy, who's the CEO of the mill. And I wrote his part of the book in the first person, so it was actually his voice. So I had to kind of try him on, as an actor would, with a character. And I wrote this first-person monologue, and it turns out that he's got a boatload of problems that have nothing to do with paper mills, and he became a real person to me. And that's the person who is played by Tom Bloom in this play.
Yeah. And you've already touched on it, but can you give us a bit more of an idea of growing up in somewhere like Rumford or Mexico, how important the mill is?
You know, it was interesting. We took the cast last week to visit the Rumford Mill. We stopped at my sister's house first and all had lunch, and then we went over and had a mill tour. And what the cast told me later is they could imagine it, but they had no idea how big it would be. And so when I was growing up, I call the mill my first metaphor. It was this omnipotent, godlike creature that took up most of the riverbank, that had the power to give and take, and from nowhere in town could you not see it. It was a very powerful presence in our lives. Mm-hmm. It was our livelihood. It was our, you know, the towns couldn't exist without it. That's why the towns did exist, because it was the mill first, and then the towns grew up around it.
Yeah. And what were your memories of labor disputes and the fractiousness that would cause in the community, which is obviously central to the play?
Well, it's interesting because when I was growing up in the 1960s, the idea of bringing in replacement workers had not taken hold. This was not a common practice at all. So when I was a kid, I remember the word strike being a frightening word, but nothing that was associated with that kind of bitterness or violence. And then in the 80s, I was living in Portland at the time, but it was a completely different story. When you have people coming in from other places to take your job when you're on strike, it changes the game. It's completely, completely different. And what's happening in this play is this is the first time for this town that a strike has gone this way. The CEO has said, okay, this is what we're doing. I'm going to bring in all these people to break your back, to make you cave, and they don't cave.
So, I mean, there had been unrest during your childhood and at the mill, but there'd not really been this strike-breaking labor brought in.
No.
It was a different game. Right?
Completely, yeah. Completely different.
Yeah.
You know, there were salaried people would go in to keep the machines running, but people understood that for the most part. You just did your job. The mill didn't completely shut down. They were making, you know, not as much paper, but, it was kind of running on a skeleton crew. But it's nothing like having hundreds of people go in to produce the paper that you have been making. Mm-hmm. It just completely changes everything.
Do you have any family members or friends in that area who were involved?
My brother, my older brother, he's a lot older than I am, and in the 80s, he was the president of the union at the Rumford Mill. He lives in Jay, but he worked at the Rumford Mill. But it wasn't during one of those fractious times. I mean, there were some tough negotiations, but it wasn't actually during a strike.
Mm-hmm. And you visited the town recently. You have roots there as well. Do you have a sense of any long-lasting effects of the strike, although it was nearly 30 years ago now?
I don't think so, really. I think that, for one thing, the mill is a shadow of its former self. When I was a kid, there were 3,300 workers there, and now it's, you know, between 600 and 800, depending on which machines are up or down. The towns are half the population they were when I was growing up there. So it's a very different place right now, which is what you can say about so many towns around Maine and the country when the kind of the lifeblood of manufacturing leaves, the community dwindles. And that's what's happening there as well. There's still people there. There's still wonderful people there. I married a boy from Rumford, so I have two families up there. But it is very different. It looks different, and it feels different from when I was a child.
Back to the play. What's the lesson you want people to take away from this that you think of when you were writing it? What's the key theme, the key takeaway, do you think?
I don't think in terms of lessons when I talk about my work. What I really want is for a theater goer, I was going to say a reader, a theater goer to feel as if he or she has experienced another life for a couple of hours, and to go away thinking about what that other life might be like, think about people that maybe you haven't given a lot of thought to before. I think the point of all literature is to engender empathy in human beings, and I hope my play does that.
Mm. And it's centrally, the theme really is family relationships, would you say?
It is family relationships. Yeah. It's the fact that we always have more in common than not, no matter how divided we may seem on the surface. We're all, you know, parents or children or neighbors or friends, and that's what survives.
Okay. Final thought, you know, any kind of interesting production challenges you've come across in either getting the accents right or getting bits of paper, maybe machinery, the props, or anything?
Well, you'll probably appreciate this, Tom. The one note I have, because I try to be a little bit hands-off, I like to be surprised by the actors. I like to leave the actors room to interpret how they want to. But the one note I had on the script is, people from Maine speak in all different ways, so it is recommended not to try to use a Maine accent, because that drives me crazy. So they're just speaking the way they speak, which is the way a lot of people in Maine speak, with a more, you know, more neutral.
Everyone has a Maine accent, do they?
No, I'm noticing that right now, looking at you. No, it's true. It's not, not everybody, especially now, you know. But let me see, production things. It's been fascinating just watching, you know, as Sally Wood, who's a brilliant director, by the way, as she blocks a scene, sometimes a line will suddenly not be quite right because of where one person is speaking to the other or something. And I've made little adjustments that way because I like so much the way she is literally envisioning, you know, the vision on the stage. I really love the shapes she makes on the stage. And sometimes what she does helps inform what I really want and didn't realize I wanted until I see actors in motion. And I think, you know what, I think that line should come later rather than sooner. Or there's a couple of lines I've just dropped altogether because they're being acted. They don't need to be said.